Hi, this is Paul. John Vervaeke this morning tweeted out a video by a channel called Equality Existence. This woman's been making videos for just about as long as I have, and not a lot of subs on her channel. But John pointed this out, this video that she did going back over the conversation that John Vervaeke and Jonathan Peugeot had. And I thought I agree with John Vervaeke that this was a quality video. She did a lot of the kind of things that I did, but I thought she did it really well. She sort of walked through the conversation and slowed it down, which I know I really need to think it through and think about what they're saying and see if I really understand what John Vervaeke and Jonathan Peugeot are saying. And well, I'll play a little clip of this later. This kind of jumps on a video that I planned out last week but never had time to pull off. John Vervaeke, of course, continues to do quite a few things beyond just the meaning crisis videos that he's been doing. And what's been fun about some of these other videos is he gets into some of the things that we're going to be getting a little bit later in the meaning crisis video. So I've been excited about that. And I haven't really kept up with doing necessarily commentary on the meaning crisis video, partly because, especially with John, he's laying all of this out systematically, and I want to sort of see where he goes before, so that I can contextualize the different parts. When John and I talk, I'm sure we're going to talk about the Protestant Reformation and some of those issues. Because it's actually sometimes when he's talking about Luther, I think he's really talking about Calvin. And there's so much nuance and complexity and resolution within religious traditions that it's very, very difficult to talk about them, especially with people who aren't immersed in those religious traditions, for the conversations to be considered to be fair by people within the religious traditions. This is a continual problem. And it's not just a problem with Christianity or Protestantism. It's a problem with me, let's say, talking about Buddhism. So, because compared to what I know about the history of Christianity, of which I know, and I can only know just a little bit, the same is true of my knowledge of some of these other religions that I'm not a participant or a practitioner or a player in. And so that's what makes having these conversations just so incredibly difficult, because there's so much that I will get wrong and so many ways that I can probably rightly be perceived as being unfair to other people's religious traditions, just simply out of ignorance and judgmentalism and all kinds of flaws on my part. And I'm not saying that's what John Vervaeke's doing, but it's so when Christians listen to Vervaeke, there's, especially from within a Christian tradition, it's going to be difficult to work through. But I've really appreciated his series, partly because it's helped me see and get some inklings from a different perspective on how religious traditions work, not just Christianity but others. And I've learned a tremendous amount through the series. So at some point, John and I are going to have a conversation, or maybe more than one, and I look forward to that. But I've kind of held off on that because he's putting a lot out there, and it really takes time to digest it and think about it. And so often I comment on things unfairly because you're getting my first drafts in these videos. And later, upon further reflection, I'll think, well, I probably shouldn't have said that. I think I was probably wrong. But This is what it takes, what it means to have a conversation. He noted that Plato, and I just today posted my conversation with Mark Vernon, and I think some of the stuff that I'll be talking with Mark Vernon about will bear on this, because Mark Vernon knows a lot about Plato. That's what he got his PhD in. There are these interesting transitions that happen, and I'm probably going to have to do a words that fudge video on consciousness, because all of these really big words I'm continuing to just wrestle with and try to work through. But of course, Owen Barfield had this idea that words are fossils of consciousness. And this is why we read. This is why we read ancient stuff. This is why C.S. Lewis advises people not to practice chronological snobbery, but to read ancient material and to work through different perspectives of seeing the world today in a context that says it values multiculturalism. We so easily simply dismiss the vast majority of cultures that have ever been in the world that have been in the past. And and these are accessible to us in a limited way via their writings and their words. And so we should plumb these depths. So, for example, Plato, as during the transition of, and Verveke runs through this nicely, you know, in Egypt, you've got the hieroglyphics, you've got the cuneiform, and then when you get alphabets, and increasingly we outsource our information storage to texts, and now via the internet and our smartphones. At the meetup last night, I was trying to think of something between Christianity and Mormonism, and I pull out my smartphone and I pull up my blog, because someone quipped, "Oh, that's where you store all your knowledge." Well, that's right. I do store my knowledge on my blog, and I store it in my Kindle library, and I store it in my YouTube files and all of this stuff. So I got to keep an eye on the time, because I got a conversation in an hour and 15 minutes. I'm not going to have time to do this video. Anyway, Plato was suspicious about writing and how it could change us, and rightfully so. And so he does these dialogues, which are a particular kind of writing. And these dialogues are different than, let's say, reading poetry. And once you get into the Owen Barfield stuff and the Jordan Peterson stuff, you're gonna hear a lot about poetry. Because poetry is a different sort of writing. And a lot of the Bible is poetry. And most of the poetry in the Bible, Christians who will say, well, the Bible is the Word of God and I believe it, all of those things, well, vast portions of the Bible they simply ignore. And because it's hard. You know, the prophets, the Old Testament prophets, are, it's just all poetry. And most Christians just simply ignore it because they don't know what to do with it. Or they have a theological framework that, in a sense, puts it over here and says, oh, you don't have to worry about that. Then you've got narrative, which is another form of, it's another form of writing, obviously. But the point is, the way that we encounter this biblical text, the way that we encounter this spoken word, most of us, we can't help but approach it in a rather naive way, because the only way that we've known to approach it is the way that we've approached it. And this is why moving into another culture is really helpful, living in another culture, learning another language. Anything that can get you out of the bubble of your culture will raise your awareness that there are multiple cultures going on. And this is not just true horizontally in terms of all of the cultures around the world now, but it's very true historically, going back over cultures, and people have seen the world through different eyes. And we have this bias, of course, to, we can't help but believe what we see and what we believe, because that's just what it means to live. But it's helpful then to study these other ways, but that's also disorienting, because what pluralism does often is enables a certain skepticism about ourselves. Can I really see the truth? Do I really know the right way? Is this really all there is? So around 1200 BC, John Verveke talks about, or 1280, sorry, John Verveke talks about this transition from Lectio Divina into this more propositional form of reading. So let's listen to that part in this video.
Okay, let's go back to dating it. 1200, you said, around.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, what happened around 1200?
Well, what starts to happen is, so notice we've talked about this indwelling internalization, and one of the things we do, because we're sort of natural born cyborgs, as Clark would say, right, is we have this kind of identification relationship to some technologies, right, and not only physical technologies. This is a physical technology. We can do it with what I call psychotechnologies. This is a notion influenced by people like David Olson and Vygotsky and others. Right, like literacy is one of my prototypical examples. You're using literacy right now in your notes, right? And so what that does, notice what you've done. You've put your thoughts on paper, so you don't have to, you can reflect on your thoughts without having to hold it in working memory, right? You can go back and correct your thoughts. You can connect previous instances of when you were thinking to instances now, to future instances. You could have me read it and connect your, so it just massively empowers your processing, right? So these psychotechnologies, and we
what are some other examples of psychotechnology?
Numeracy is another psychotechnology.
Coding, an example of psychotechnology?
You mean computer coding?
Computer coding.
I would need to ask people, but I imagine it is. I imagine if they've started to understand and think, you know, through. So they, if they've started internalizing and thinking in terms of coding and sort of, you know.
So it has to be related to the cognition, because it doesn't just, it's not just what expands the amount that you, well, I guess that's technology.
Yeah, yeah, that's right, that's right. So, right. Notice how, like I said, notice how second nature literacy is to, if you try to, if I ask you to look at those pages, and don't cheat by like unfocusing your eyes, look at the marks and don't read them. It's almost impossible for you to do that. It's become so internalized.
And it seems like it's innate. It seems like it's
innate. It seems natural to you.
It seems like it's natural to all of humans.
But it's not, because of course for overwhelming most of history, for overwhelming most of humanity, people were illiterate. Right?
And there's still some people who are.
And we have to teach people to become literate. Okay, so all of that. Okay. So how people relate to literacy, and I think one of the things that drove the Oxford Revolution was a change in literacy, a change from hieroglyphic cuneiform literacy to alphabetic literacy. And so when you see changes in how people relate to literacy, that can help drive significant changes in our cognition and even our consciousness, how we understand ourselves, how we understand the world. I think that, for example, and I argue in the series, that the change to alphabetic literacy helped to drive the generation of the two world mythology. So what I think one of the things that's happening in the 12th century, and this is an argument I think made by Chetham, but I think he's citing somebody else. I think it's Kahn's. Anyways, the argument is people started to read differently in the 12th century. And what's interesting is I've taught myself to read in the way they read before. This change.
So the
reading that I've learned, it's called Lectio Divina. It's still practiced in sort of.
And now this is when he said that, he immediately caught my interest, because Lectio Divina has become a very popular thing in certain Protestant circles over the last 50 years or so. Protestants, in a way, have been undoing some of the Protestant Reformation and rediscovering ancient Christian practices like Lectio Divina, like meditation, like playing around with weekend monasticism. You know, Dallas Willard with his spiritual formation. I mean, all of these things have been making inroads into the Protestant church. One of our sister churches here in Sacramento just did a little seminar in Lectio Divina. It's very, very hot right now in a lot of Protestant groups. And this fascinates me to hear, well, and so then he starts talking about, well, what do you mean by these different kinds of reading?
Religious and sort of Neoplatonic communities, right? So when I'm, think about, here's where you probably might be doing it, when you're reading a poem, right? Now you might just read it in your head. And then what that tends to get you thinking is, right, is that, you know, the ideas and the meaning are in your head, and you think of it largely propositionally. But what you should do, and in fact, if you've had a good teacher of poetry, is poetry should be read aloud, right? You should read the poetry aloud, because you're trying to use the meter and the rhythm, right? And, you know, some poets will even use the graphic shape of the poem. So you're trying to use all of this stuff around the proposition to trigger these other aspects of knowing.
And I think this has a lot to do with YouTube, because YouTube is, in a sense, this new technology of deliverable flat. Now, when I talk a little bit about, I'm going to talk with Bern Power tomorrow about texture, because he had a very interesting video, which was a recording of a lecture that he gave at Labrie about texture. But YouTube is, in a sense, a vivification of the spoken word. And so we're all experimenting in this now.
The perspectival, the procedural, the participatory. And use the graphic shape of the poem. So you're trying to use all of this stuff around the proposition to trigger these other aspects of knowing. The perspectival, the procedural, the participatory, right? And so people were reading and they were reciting text. And they were often reading in concert. So it was also, right, not just individual. It was shared and communal.
And of course, if you're churches have been doing this stuff for a very long time, and it never stopped happening in the church. Even in our very sparse liturgy at Living Stones, every Sunday we will read part of or an entire psalm, and we will read it together, and we'll read it antiphonally. And the context of reading that psalm in the place of worship is very different from being at home reading it in your, you know, Protestant daily quiet time or whatever. And so this stuff hasn't gone out of fashion. It's just a lot of people have stepped out of it, partly because as a culture we looked at and said, well, I can read that at home. Not being aware enough that actually reading it together and practicing it communally is a different thing from just reading it at home. It's just not a matter of gaining the information. And I think a lot of people have given up on Bible reading because they thought, well, I've read the Bible before. Well, but we're doing something different. And often I'll tell people who are coming to me and they're trying to learn how to pray. And I'll say, well, try praying the Psalms. And they're like, what do you mean? Well, read the Psalm if you're not going to bother anybody. Read the psalm out loud to God. Well, that would feel weird. Yeah, part of it is it's supposed to feel weird, especially at first. And then you'd say, well, I read stuff in that psalm, and I think, well, I don't know if I should say that. Well, this is part of the dislocation and the shaking up of who you are. So this stuff hasn't really gone away.
I remember hearing that one of the first people, not the first people, but somebody, I think Caesar could read in his head, and people thought he was a superhuman.
Yeah, so...
So it wasn't that common. What we think, yeah. Take it for
well,
granted.
Yeah, and so, and that's one of the reasons why we started inventing more and more sophisticated punctuation, so that we could read in our head rather than having to read aloud.
Because it's faster.
Yeah, it's faster, and it's much more important.
So it has its advantages, but then there's a disadvantage. Course.
Yes, it has significant advantages. I'm not saying to anybody stop silent reading, but what happens is, right, you go through this change, right, where you go from, I have to be participating, involved, I have to be going through a transformation as I'm engaging with the text. Like, and that's what we often still read when we're reading poetry properly. We want the poem to transform us, to change. We're not just trying to get the information from the poem. We want to undergo some experience, some transformation.
Is this related to faith or doth?
The
hoth? Yeah, I don't know how to
The hoth.
Because I know that has to do with experiencing something.
Yeah, that's participatory knowing.
So is this related, or is this
yes,
just,
totally.
It just seems like it is?
It is. So the hoth, right, the participatory knowing, you see it in the Bible in the Old Testament because it's used both of like a relationship, like of faith, as you said, but it's also used as the term for sexual intercourse because in sexual intercourse you become intimately participatory with another human being. You're actually conforming and there's deep perspectival engagement, right? And so, that knowing by loving, by having a loving interaction with something. Notice why that makes sense. When I'm involved in these loops, remember we did the addiction and it gets narrowed? Mm-hmm. Well, love is the other way, right? What love does, even when you're loving an object, if I put it that way, right? And Aaron showed this in his work, this mutually accelerating disclosure. Like, so what happens is in addiction, you get the reciprocal narrowing, mm-hmm. but in love, you get the reciprocal opening up. Mm-hmm. So I start to, you get what I call reciprocal realization. I start to realize more about my partner, right? And that allows me to connect more deeply to her.
Who started this idea? You said it and you gave a name just now.
Which one?
That love opens up.
Point to, well, I mean, the idea of it being mutually accelerating disclosure is a researcher called, his last name is Aaron. I think the idea goes
It's just back. Interesting, that's why I'm...
Well, no. I think the idea goes back...
I think people would want to research it.
Yeah, I think the idea goes back to Plato. Ultimately, this because Plato sees a deep connection between love and wisdom, and the process that Plato talked about as anagoge is this kind of reciprocal opening up, right? His idea, when I look at beautiful things, that sort of transforms me and makes me a more beautiful person, which then allows me to see deeper and more profound aspects of beauty that then. You know, sort of beautiful, and what happens is it ends up, and that's what happens when you're in love with somebody. You know, you're getting to the depths of the person, and that affords them getting to the depths of you, and you sort of reciprocally realize each other in very powerful ways. Okay. So what happens is people start go from, if you'll allow me this to extend this, mm-hmm. people go from reading the text in a loving manner, mm-hmm. okay, to reading the text in a purely propositional, inferential manner.
Now this very much happened in the history of Christian theology. And when you get to, part of what happens in the West is that the vision of science and the, I would say, the acquisitive spirit by which we attempted to grasp onto science, theology looked at that and said, we need to keep up with this knowledge arms race. And so what happened in theology is that theology took on this sort of scientistic manner and abandoned this love relationship with the text. Now, again, this was not completely abandoned. It continued to be practiced in churches, and it continued to be practiced as individuals. It wasn't abandoned, but in some areas, in terms of, this is sort of where how culture works, because as Jordan Peterson rightly notes, we keep an eye on each other with respect to status, and we're highly tuned for that. And so when we see science people gaining status, anybody who has a score of agreeableness higher than 20, you know, really starts getting pulled over there. Of course, the low in agreeableness, if you go to the Sacramento Jordan Peterson meetup, you can meet a whole bunch of people at zero in agreeableness, but that's just our group. But again, one of the benefits of religious traditions is that they're highly conservative, and you might say, wow, that's a problem. Well, it is and it isn't. It isn't a problem when we, for very bad reasons, just start jettisoning a whole bunch of stuff that older generations knew was valuable. We've lost the understanding of why they're valuable, so we simply jettison them. Now suddenly we realize everything that we've thrown away.
How is it reading in a loving manner if you read it out loud and you have the cadence and you try to get into it? How's that loving?
Because what you're trying to do,
you're giving it time. Time and love are deeply connected because time is life and giving life is love.
Do is you're trying to trigger, right? You're trying to trigger all aspects of your information processing that are much more procedural and perspectival. And I mean, because you're listening.
So it's like the difference between reading a script and then acting out the script.
Exactly. And it's why, and I tell people this all the time. I was telling my son this other day. In fact, my older son was telling my younger son, don't read Shakespeare. It won't make any sense to you. You have to go and see Shakespeare. You have to go and you have to hear them and see them acting and moving around and see how the words are connected to their characters and the identities. And then Shakespeare makes all this deep sense to you.
Now, does this only apply to poetry? Like if you're reading a nonfiction book, so The Shallows right there, or yeah. What is an emotion?
Yeah.
Are you going to act that out, and do you gain something from that?
Well, I mean, it depends.
Obviously, you lose speed.
Well, it depends what my project is. I mean, again, what are my goals? What's the task? What's the set of problems I'm trying to solve, right? I think some philosophical texts should be read in this fashion. I mean, I think there's a good reason why Plato wrote in dialogues, as rather than just in a simple...
Yeah, I've always found that strange.
Yeah, because he's trying to trigger the perspectival, right, and the participatory. And he's trying to put you into the kind of knowing that would allow you to indwell the dialogue and internalize Socrates.
And what's interesting is we don't know that Plato knew he was doing that necessarily consciously. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. But this is what we do. We, especially when we practice things from the past, we don't know why we're doing it. And we had a phase over the last 100 years or so when if you couldn't say why you're doing it, then there isn't a good reason. And this idea has been stuck in our culture. And it's really an idea that has to go. And I'm not saying we shouldn't think critically and examine, but just not having an idea is sometimes not sufficient for casting something out.
Now, let's go back to it. People start reading differently, and so this starts to come to the fore, the idea that I can get information without having to go through transformation. Okay? And you say, okay.
That's really important. I can get information without going to transformation. Now, I'm going to have to probably this week make another video on Jordan Peterson and his believing in God thing, because he did a longer thing on that, and I posted a little something on Twitter, but I want to dig into that for because what Peterson, in a sense, says there is that I shouldn't say I believe in God because I have not been transformed by God, according to this image that Jordan has about what God is. So that, what John Vervaeke said right there, is critically important. So I'll play it again.
Who cares? Okay. And this starts to come to the fore, the idea that I can get information without having to go through transformation.
And I think part of the truth of that is information does transform us. And we know that. And we have that built into this little phrase, I can't unsee that. Because that information, just that image, just that visual, and this is in comedy, I walked in and saw my parents having sex, I can't unsee that. Or you see your wife cheating on you, you can't unsee that. Information is transformation, and in our information age, we have denied that at our peril. At the same time, we treat information as just a consumable without respecting the transformation. So in a sense, there's problems on both sides of that.
Okay? And you say, okay, who cares? Okay. What are most of the texts? The texts are religious texts. Clearly, it's 12th century. Okay? And this is an idea that, you know, that Jensen Kim and I talk about a lot, right? And I owe a lot to him about this, right? But it's also in Kanza's work and Chatham's work, right? It used to be that you could only gain access, if this is the right word, to God, the deepest reality. You could only have that knowing by going through transformation. So theology was always linked to the process of spiritual transformation.
And this, what he said just right there, is key. Because one of the things that happened when theology decided it wanted to be a science, just like all the other sciences, is it destroyed that link. A couple of years ago, one of our pastors, a pastor over in Davis, said, I want to start a semistery. So what do you mean you want to start a semistery? Because throughout the history of the church, pastors have been trained within the church. And what happens after the Reformation, a ways after the Reformation, is that pastors get trained in schools. Now, it's important to remember that schools used to be monasteries, in a sense. And so this relationship between knowledge and God has been a very complex one throughout history. But, you know, what he said right there is crucial in that.
That knowing by going through transformation. So theology was always linked to the process of spiritual transformation. But what starts to happen is I can do theology, I can generate propositions and beliefs about God without having to go through any transformation. So theology gets divorced from self-transcendence.
Around the year 1200?
Yeah, that's when it starts happening.
Why?
Because the reading is changing.
Ah, okay. And the reading changed because...
And this is one of the areas I'm going to want to talk to John about, because I want to know a lot more about this. And so I'm waiting for him to get into this in his series, because I'm probably going to want to take a look at some of the books. He's good at giving book references. And so this is something I'm very curious about. Peugeot has said something very similar to it.
Probably for reasons you said. There's many ways in which I can make my reading much more efficient, much more effective. I can consume more information. Right. If I read in this silent fashion, but now I start to think of myself inside my head, and that I am my beliefs, and that meaning is in the propositions in my head, rather than the meaning that was carried in this reciprocal realization between me and the text, and this mutual transformation. Right. And
so now there's a separation.
That's right. Yeah. And at the same time, Aristotle's being rediscovered. Right. And so Aristotle is, like, to the ancient world, he's science. He literally writes all the books on science, like literally, right? And so when Aristotle's being rediscovered, You know, you've got all this scientific knowledge that's coming in, and it can't be ignored by the Christian church, right? It can't be ignored because of the authority they give to the ancient world.
And I've been reading about this actually recently. At first, Aristotle was banned, and then, of course, he was embraced, and Thomas Aquinas then creates a synthesis.
Also because, you know, Aristotle and Plato, you know, had deep influences on people like Augustine. And so they can't just ignore Aristotle, but they can't simply assimilate.
So they've already respected Aristotle or
the
Greeks?
There's a respect for Aristotle that has been set up within sort of some of, it's in the warp and the woof of you know, the way in which Christianity had integrated with the Platonic tradition.
Around what year was that?
Oh, so the integration with the Platonic tradition starts much, much earlier.
Was it Aquinas?
Oh, no, that's much later. I mean, I'm actually getting to Aquinas in this picture that we're talking about. But no, this is much earlier. You're seeing this in the, you know, in the 3rd and 4th century, and most especially in the 5th century with Augustine. Augustine is the person that really fuses Christianity and Platonism together. But you're also seeing it in Eastern Christianity. You're seeing it with Pseudo-Dionysius.
And when you say he's fusing it, it's not as if he's taking passages from Aristotle and putting it in the Bible.
No, what you mean
is he's respecting their line of thinking and then applying it to the Bible?
Yes. So, in fact, Augustine famously argued that he could not have become a Christian until he was exposed to Platonism, because Plato's way of thinking about, like, the upper world, right, the Platonic way of thinking...
Like the idealized world?
Yeah. That gave Augustine, because Augustine was a very much sort of a materialist in his way of thinking, and he couldn't get into Christianity because he didn't know how to relate to this God, that this invisible, unseeable.
He was an atheist before.
Well, no, he's a Manichaeist. He follows the religion of Mani, which was a very sort of dualistic, very materialistic, especially his version of it.
We'll start there. I sometimes forget exactly where I want to dip out of these things. Now, along the way, and again, people throw such fun things at me. So I'm doing the Gospel of John in my adult Sunday school class. And so someone shoots me this from St. Elijah Church somewhere in Middle America, this wonderful series, very long series. Of course, I love a very long series, on the Gospel of John. And I was listening to this video, and I thought, this is exactly what Verveke is talking about. So let's listen to some of this.
The ancient church used the word Passover. The word Passover in Hebrew is Pesach. You put that into Greek and it's Pascha. And that is the word that the Eastern church has always used. The Western church uses the word Easter. So when I say Pascha, I mean what the West means by Easter. So we have Pascha. And at Pascha, all converts were baptized on Holy Saturday before we had Pascha beginning at midnight, Easter service held at midnight, in which they would receive their first Eucharist. So you had baptism and Eucharist centering here on Holy Saturday of Holy Week. Holy Week would have been the week immediately before that Sunday, Pascha Sunday. And then we had a period here that we call Great Lent. That's where we're talking about now. The oral instruction took places in two stages. The first stage of instruction, catechesis, occurred during the 7 weeks of Lent and Holy Week prior to their baptism, chrismation, on Holy Saturday. The catechumens were called photizomenoi, to be enlightened ones, photizomenoi. After their baptism and first Eucharist, the newly baptized were called neophotistoi, the newly enlightened ones. They now entered the second stage of instruction, mystagogy. So here is Pascha. All of this catechesis, learning the story of Christ, from his baptism all the way up to Holy Week, and then here getting baptized and receiving the body and blood of Christ at Eucharist, is now going to be followed on this side by mystagogy. Mr. Godzik instruction up to the day of Pentecost. 50 days after Pascha.
Now, it's important to note that this, and he's going to talk about the Gospel of Mark, and then Matthew and Luke, alongside with the Gospel of Mark, that's the catechesis. That's the preparation for baptism and formal inclusion into the church. And then mystagogic instruction is the Gospel of John, which follows from that. Now it's important to recognize that this, when we think about catechesis, and this is very interesting for me, because of course in the Protestant tradition we have the Heidelberg Catechism, which functions similarly, but when I think about what's in the Gospel of Mark versus what's in the Heidelberg Catechism, it's very interesting, and it leads me into Dallas Willard land and reading Dallas Willard's best book, The Divine Conspiracy. But it's fascinating here how it's important to think about that. Again, if you look at these traditions, you talk to Jonathan Pageau, or now that I have a number of people I know through the meetup that are undergoing catechesis within the Orthodox Church, it's interesting to me how, you know, the way when you go to an Orthodox church you have to stand through all that liturgy. And one of the members of my meetup, it was after Holy Week, comes and holds up this big book. He said, "We just did this whole book in liturgy." And again, the point from the Verveke thing is that they didn't just sit there and read through it. Okay, I read through this book, I know it. It's a different kind of knowledge. As a community, you're standing up there, and again, when in an Orthodox church, or you're within this building, and you're within all of this. And actually, Jonathan Pageau goes into this in the clips that Quality Existence plays of that Verveke Pageau video. So I very much recommend listening to it. It's a nice way to kind of understand that Verveke Pageau interview that happened. And so Jonathan Pageau says, you know, I want to get into this place, and I want to be surrounded by this. I want to get immersed in this. I want to be in the story in this way.
During the 7 weeks following Pascha, the newly baptized then received mystagogic instruction into the meaning of their faith and into experiencing the presence of the risen Savior in their lives.
Now listen to the language here, okay? Into the meaning of their faith, into experiencing the presence of the Savior in their lives. How are they going to do this? They're going to do it something much more similar to Lectio Divina. Not exactly, because obviously Lectio Divina, especially within the Western tradition, has a specific understanding, but the same technology is going to be used.
The ancient mystagogic instruction of the church is found in John's Gospel. The Synoptic Gospels grew out of the Lenten catechesis of those preparing for baptism. The Synoptics make sure believers know the story of Jesus. John's mystagogic Gospel grew out of the mystagogic instruction of the newly baptized given between Pascha and Pentecost. The mystagogic Gospel takes believers into a deeper understanding of the resurrected Jesus who is present in our midst today. John created a mystagogic Gospel that allowed his listeners to participate, enter into and experience the one who is truth itself, the truth that is the Gospel. You see, there is no past tense to the resurrection. The resurrection is transformative. The risen Savior still opens the eyes of believers to understand the Scriptures. Jesus was not an add-on to the ancient Israelite story. He is the story all along.
Now some of you who are Protestants and listening to this, I'm not going to do it right now, but I could pull up Tim Keller quotes that say nearly the same thing, C.S. Lewis quotes that say nearly the same thing. The point of the resurrection is not as, and again, I got to be careful with this, Jordan Peterson and Sam Harris focus on, well, maybe did Jesus rise from the dead? And again, if you've listened to any of my videos, you know what I believe about this, and you know what I believe about the importance of this, about the physical resurrection of Jesus. So don't take what I'm about to say as anything taking away from that. But that event, the importance of it, does not, in fact, is not, in fact, exhausted by the event. That's part of Christian theology. In fact, Christians lived within the resurrection. That's what happens in Christian theology. And so, and this gets into, you know, people would sometimes ask me, well, even if Jesus rose from the dead 2,000 years ago, so what? If I can't lay my hands on him now, and if I don't see him, you know, turning water to wine, if I don't see him stilling a storm or walking on the sea, you know, I don't care. That's a framing of reference, a framing of the world that, well, like many of our frames, we can't see it. It's the frame within which they live. But my point here about what he just said about the resurrection is this isn't something that only the Orthodox Church believes. This is common to, this is mere Christianity.
The things written in the Old Testament are about Jesus.
Now, that some of the dispensationalists, I think, wander off the trail on this, Mark. But the understanding of the Old Testament that he just asserted, you know, the Orthodox Church believes it, the Catholic Church believes it, some of the older Protestant churches believe it, including my tradition. And again, I can pull up plenty of Tim Keller sermons where he basically says what Jesus does after the resurrection is open their eyes to the scriptures. That's what the resurrection does.
Even as Peter took his stand with the apostles on the day of Pentecost, John took his stand with Peter and Paul, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and proclaimed the gospel shared in common within the church. You search the scriptures, for in them you think you have eternal life. And these are they which testify of me. But you are not willing to come to me that you may have life. John's gospel is not a book to be studied. John did not write more scripture to be searched. It isn't the words on the written page that give life. John's gospel is mystagogic. It offers the opportunity to enter into and experience the very things being described and discussed. Now, there is value in reading John's gospel piously, just reading it. And there is value in reading it academically. But for those desiring to enter into the fullness of this gospel, and for those asking for more than what they have, Jesus still says, come and see. John's gospel is mystagogic. He offers a journey to be taken, a journey to see Jesus. 2,000 years later, hungry and thirsty people still come saying, sir, we wish to see Jesus. The experience and illumination gained remain ineffable and cannot be quantified or reduced to academic conclusions or literary documents.
Right there. What he said right there is really important. They remain ineffable. Now, what does he mean by that? In a sense, what he's saying is that you can't take this and exhaust it with words, all right? It's basically what Verveke is talking about, that there's another layer here going on. And in fact, the practice, that the way that you regard, the way that you live with the text is a different thing than just the words themselves.
This is a journey not to understand a book, but a journey to meet a person. This is a journey to see Jesus. It is also a journey with Jesus. It is a journey into the mystery of his truth. Mystagogy, Catechism, and Mystagogy Part 2.
Okay, so that's as far as we'll go with that. But you can see, and in fact, if you didn't see, well, some of the interesting stuff in here is also about inscripturation, which I just started the Gospel of John in my Sunday school class, and noticing where this begins at in the Gospel of John begins, even with the prologue, we're already in a sense into John the Baptist and the baptism of Jesus. And thinking about that was really helpful in terms of fleshing out, oh, why are these books shaped the way they are? Because that's a constant conversation among scholars. Why are these books shaped the way they are? And when you understand it within the life of a community, well, it begins to make a lot more sense. And you understand participation via liturgy in terms of community, in terms of what John Vervaeke just said, again, it begins to make a lot more sense. Now, John was just on Rebel Wisdom with...
the things I talk about in the series is the difference.
With Jordan Hall. And again, very similar to what we just heard, but a little bit different, so I wanted to play this too.
In which people read text, for example, as an example, to try to start deepening the metaphor. So I compare how we read text. We tend to read text, right, in a consummatory fashion. We're taking in the propositions. We're looking for the logical coherence between the propositions in our head. And we're sort of living inside of our head in that way. And then before that, typified in what people do in Lectio Divina, right, was this reading that was recitation. It was done communally, and right, and it's meant to be participatory, like the way you read a poem, or the way you sort of set yourself to appreciate music.
Now, it's also important to recognize that this is so recent. When I was growing up, we'd sit around the table and we'd have dinner, and my father sometimes would recite poems that he learned in his public one-room schoolhouse in the middle of the prairie growing up in the 19... He was born in... Okay, so he was in the late 30s, early 40s when he was growing up. That was a part of education. Now, we have changed education in this country to the part where we no longer... practice rote memorization, partly because we have all these books around us, and so we can keep the information in these books. But something else is lost in the losing of in the losing of that practice. And people have known that, but I don't know that we've known all that we've lost in that practice.
And then the whole point of that was not just to take in the information and consume it, but the idea was that you could actually only approach the reality that the words were referring to if you were allowed something other than just the semantic content to engage you in a transformative process, right? So it was very much this idea that you can't, these deeper realities require a transformation before we can appropriately grasp, you know, the meaning of the words that are being uttered. And so So Kranz and others talk about, you know, the notion of the self was a much more extensive notion. It was involved with others and with the text, rather than being sort of locked inside the head and locked inside the propositions.
And this is where, you know, we could get into at some point, probably get into some of the Barfield stuff, because even the notion of the self, you can hear plenty of, I could quote plenty of Tim Keller for this. Your identity was received. It wasn't achieved. You were always a part of your community. This is your identity. You didn't have to develop this yourself. And it was built into the text. And so if, you know, Julian in the comment section, I've had Julian on the channel a couple times and should have him on again sometime. You know, Julian is a Hutterite, and he is embedded very much within his religious community, and so the community and the text, and Julian, you know, Julian welds dumpsters, and you think, well, why, well, such a sharp young man, why is he welding dumpsters? Because part of the communal tradition is working with his hands, and that leaves him time to listen to my videos. What a wonderful thing. But this is, and it breaks us out of this, the little bubble, which is 2019 in whatever little space you are, and which for many of us is just within our little heads.
Now, why all of this is relevant to me and I think to our conversation is because, right, one of the core aspects of what people reliably seem to be pointing towards when they're seeking meaning is this sense of deep connectedness, connectedness to themselves, to each other, and to a reality that in some sense is greater than them. And it's interesting because I think, well, this is what it seems to me, I think you're doing something very analogous with spoken discourse as what people were doing with the reading, which was also being spoken, by the way. What I mean by that is you're trying to bring back, right, the connectedness of the communication process.
Now, he'll go into that more, and you should watch that video. But he's exactly right, the connectedness of this process. Now, part of what's happened in, let's say, the history of the Christian Reformed Church, these Dutch immigrants came to the United States in the latter part of the 19th, early part of the 20th century, and they shared a common language different from the outside world. They shared a common community. They created institutions. They did all of this stuff, the catechism, the Bible reading, pietistic practices, all of this gave people an incredible sense of community and meaning, and they were able to build institutions and do all of this. Well, part of what happened was that the rest of the world came in. You had newspapers and radio and then television and now the internet. And so so we don't know what community we're a part of. And I think increasingly that community is mediated by our social networks and the smartphone. And okay, what's going to be the ramifications of this? I don't know that we know. Now, one of the things that I picked up, you know, Viktor Frankl and the meaning crisis. Viktor Frankl, Viktor Frankl survived the death camps and very much understood the meaning crisis because it was right there. Nothing will focus you like a concentration camp and the meaning crisis. And Viktor Frankl, if you've never read Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl, it's a must read. Because he basically notes that people with meaning, people with purpose, that can't be touched by the people imprisoning you, they survived. Those who didn't have that, they didn't make it.
Bringing to a very narrow path, a very narrow window, which is for us to make it as a species through the exterior aspects of the crisis that we find.
Now, Jordan Hall and John Vervaeke were talking about threats that threaten us, that we're, especially in this kind of media context we have. And there's been a lot of attention paid to the media context because we're increasingly aware that those who are serving up the agendas of our lives, what is their agenda? And, you know, there's tremendous conversation right now about Google and what is Google's agenda. And Google's just been kicked out of the Pride Parade in San Francisco because the organizers of the Pride Parade don't believe that Google is sufficiently down with their program because they haven't clamped down on Crowder and others. And so, you know, all of this is going on. And so you have the question of, well, what community are we living within? What, in fact, are the existential threats that we face? Because dependent on the frame here, whatever your frame here, that will determine what you respond and how you live.
We must, as individuals, first make it through the interior crisis of becoming transformed and to be allowing ourselves to be intimately and vulnerably transformed by the reality that is in fact simply there.
And I like Jordan Hall's phrasing here because he nicely showed the connection, which is so often lost, between the interior and the exterior, that be transformed by the renewal of your heart, the Apostle Paul says in Romans 12. So, well, we're gonna get into that in a minute.
Mm-hmm. And to be in relationship with it, with nothing between us and it, so that we can at long last respond to what is really happening and discover in ourselves that capacity to be responsive to what is really happening, which is such a funny thing. Like, it's literally right there. Mm-hmm. It's right in front of us. It's at our hands. It's really a choice to be able to reach out and grab the response to the meeting crisis.
Now, of course, you're going to have the question, well, how do we know what the real threats are? Because I think part of, for example, the losses experienced by the church have been a skepticism about the threats that church leadership have asserted others to have. So these things that you said were evil, I went into them and they didn't seem evil at all. They were life-giving. And this is, so right away you have this question of orientation. Well, so the meaning crisis has to do with the internal and the external. Well, how can we know? One of the things that I had, hopefully I'll get the video of the C.S. Lewis presentation that I did last week, but one of the members of our meetup was in the car with us and sharing, you know, he's using Sam Harris's meditation app. And I was very interested in this, because what you learn with the meditation app is you learn to practice a psychotechnology, and it's been put on your smartphone, and you can learn how to meditate. And what was interesting to me is, okay, when do you deploy this? Well, we deploy it when we're experiencing stress or anxiety or something is upsetting us and we want to be Zen, and it's like a pocket superpower, and you can, once you get trained in accessing a certain level of, now again, we got this fudgy word, consciousness. Once I enter this realm of consciousness, then when I might instinctively be reactive now because of this new pocket superpower I have, I can go into a Zen state and I cannot be reactive. And now I think a lot of that is good, because certainly we are suffering from a whole lot of reactivity all around us that is dealing with violence and all sorts of things. And one of the things that Viktor Frankl noted in the meaning crisis that he was pointing out, you know, in the mid-century was, you know, three major societal ills: aggression, addiction, and depression. And we would have to add anxiety to that. And so then it's a powerful thing. And we look at it as, well, this is a good, if I can just, you know, I have this pocket superpower where when I feel myself getting anxious, then I can go into a Zen state. When I feel myself getting reactive, then I can calm down. It doesn't answer the question, though, because there are sometimes you should be reactive and sometimes you shouldn't. And you certainly need the capacity to be covered with buttons and have the world pushing them. That certainly you don't want to be. But when do you need to be? When do you need to react, and how? Having the superpower doesn't answer that question. One of my favorite examples of this is a section from Tim Keller's book on preaching, where he tells this little story, where he's talking about what I call the secret sacred self. There are many severe problems with the sovereign self as a philosophy of life. To begin with, it assumes that we know what we want, and our inner desires are coherent and harmonious. Modernity tells us to discover your deepest desires and to fulfill them, but our deepest desires often conflict with one another. A desire for a stellar career will often be in conflict with the desire for a particular relationship, and our feelings constantly shift. So an identity based on our feelings will be unstable and incoherent. So again, I mean, you have to listen to your feelings, but your feelings can't be your master. So how can we deal with feelings? Well, maybe I'll have my superpower to numb my feelings. Well, that's certainly a better way than using alcohol to numb your feelings, or pot to manage your feelings, or Netflix to always manage your feelings. An even more serious problem is that an identity based on expressing ourselves without listening to the outside dictates is actually an illusion. A popular exponent of the sovereign self is Gail Sheehy in books like The Seminal Passages in 1976. She insists that you can become yourself only when you can look inside and express yourself from an external, from any external valuations and accreditations. This is patently impossible. And Keller is exactly right here. Imagine an Anglo-Saxon warrior in Britain, AD 800. He has two very strong inner impulses and feelings. One is aggression. He loves to smash and kill people when they show him disrespect. Living in a shame and honor culture with its warrior ethic, he will identify with that feeling. He will say to himself, that's me. That's who I am. I will express that. He won't really, because he's living completely embedded within that culture. He doesn't even have to say that to himself. It's just who he is. The other feeling he senses is same-sex attraction. So you got the gay Anglo-Saxon warrior from Britain, AD 800. To that, he will say, that's not me. I will control and suppress that impulse. Now imagine a young man walking around Manhattan today. He has the same two impulses, both equally strong, both difficult to control. What will he say? He will look at the aggression and think, that's not who I want to be. And he will seek deliverance in therapy and anger management programs. He will look at a sexual desire, however, and conclude, that's who I am. What does this thought experiment show us? Primarily, it reveals that we do not get our identity simply from within. Rather, we receive some interpretive moral grid, lay it down over our various feelings and impulses, and sift them through it. This grid helps us decide which feelings are me and which should be expressed and which are not and should not be expressed. So this grid of interpretive belief, not an innate, unadulterated expression of our feelings, is what shapes our identity. Despite protest to the contrary, we instinctively know our inner depths are insufficient to guide us. We need some standard or rule from outside to help us sort out the warring impulses of the interior life. And where do our Anglo-Saxon warrior and our modern Manhattan man get their grids? From their cultures, their communities, their heroic stories. They are actually not simply choosing to be themselves. They are filtering their feelings, jettisoning some, and embracing others. They are choosing to be the selves their cultures tell them they may be. In the end, an identity based independently on our own inner feelings is impossible. The reality is that we can no more bestow dignity on ourselves than identity. In fact, they go together. In The Need for Recognition, Charles Taylor quotes Gail Sheehy's book and her counsel that we must not care what others think, but that we must bestow the verdict of significance on ourselves. Taylor argues that this, too, is an impossibility. You cannot get significance through self-recognition. It must come in great measure from others. This is why we need community. In the end, you can't name yourself or bless yourself. You can't ultimately say to yourself, I don't care that everyone I know thinks I'm a monster. I love myself, and that's all that matters. That would not convince us of our worth, unless we were mentally unsound. We need someone from outside to say we are of greater worth, and the greater worth of the person telling us so. The more powerful that recognition is to our identity formation, this is where I'm probably going to get, I really want to get with John Vervaeke and talk about Luther, because he says, well, Luther, that's just narcissism, because someone arbitrarily is giving you worth. And I think we're going to have to process this together, because Keller is sort of half Lutheran, half Calvinist. And so Keller kind of shifts between those two quite a bit. So if we try to authenticate and validate ourselves, we place ourselves in an infinite loop of delusion that will lead to either narcissism or self-loathing. So actually, Keller and Vervaeke have some of the same concerns about narcissism. The unshakable need for external affirmation and recognition, along with the current denial of this fact of human nature, puts enormous pressure on the late modern self. In traditional societies, if you are simply a good son or daughter, husband or wife, farmer or mother, you are doing all your society required. That could be smothering and confining, but the bar for recognition was not impossibly high, and they experienced a ton of meaning. The modern process of identity formation, however, tells you to go out and create a self from scratch. You must identify your dreams, especially the most vivid ones, and to fulfill them or feel like a failure. That prospect crushes those in many segments of our society where money, looks, power, success, sophistication, and romantic love are all become not just good things, but necessary identity factors. And here is where Christianity's offer can be recognized as so liberating. In biblical terms, we are all socially independent and worthy interdependent, and worthy beings because we were made in the image of the triune God, the Imago Dei. This means that our value is both inherent, it comes simply from being human, and contingent. It reminds us how dependent we are upon God. It is an identity that is not achieved, but received. Likewise, in the gospel and the work of Christ, that identity is baptized into something even greater. It is not achieved through our performance of social roles, or through our fulfilling of religious and moral standards, or through our success and achievement of status. It is found in Him. Now, right there, what do you mean by that? That's tough. How do you understand that? Well, I've got 15 minutes until my conversation. Not having a record of my own that comes from my performance and effort, but that which comes through faith in Christ, the righteousness that comes from God on the basis of faith. Paraphrase of Philippians 3:9. So obviously that's something that I'm going to have to talk about in other times and in other places, but there's the Christian method, and that's a nice shorthand of where Tim Keller goes. Now I want to come back to this, and I want to play her ending, because I was really touched by it, because it speaks of, I hear a lot of this. I hear a lot of this both in the meetups and in the conversations, and so when I think about Verveke and Peugeot, they both have, I'm kind of, so you got Verveke here and Peugeot here, I'm kind of in the middle of them as a Protestant, and working this through, because I really sympathize with what John Verveke has to say, because John would say, you know, you can't go back. And he's right. We can't unlearn. And so any process which is a simply going back, I don't think will get us there. And I think this is, in fact, part of the way the world works. As I mentioned before, I'm reading this book that Ron Dart recommended, which is basically a story of Erasmus and Luther. And you know, so one of the earlier things that talked about the fact that, you know, when Aristotle really comes on the scene in medieval Europe, well, there's a crisis, and first the church wants to kind of close him off. So you're not allowed to read Aristotle. Yeah, but that just makes all the scholars really read him, so they're reading him secretly. So then they open it up, and then, of course, you've got Thomas Aquinas doing a synthesis of Aristotle, and it becomes the doctrine of the church. And then you get to Galileo. I mean, Galileo gets in trouble for defying church teaching, but it's not biblical teaching. It's Aristotelian framing of the universe. So we can't simply go back. But I think, I don't think before us is just blue skies either. There is, in fact, a reality, and the goal is to get in touch with reality, and obviously I'm a Christian minister, I lay my cards on the table, but, you know, when I listen to, I don't know her first name or her last name, but when I listen to her talk, I really sympathize, because a lot are coming to me saying similar things. So let's hear what she has to say.
Verveke indicates a need for communities, which he calls wisdom institutions, to be created where people can come together and cultivate anagoge. This may also consist of classes or dharma talks, let's just say. Peugeot sees the breakdown and resurrection of meaning already built into the grand hero narrative of Christianity, and that Christianity descends and is reborn. We continue to follow the rituals, and this is the true difference, I think, between Jordan Peterson and Verveke, which I got this wrong last time. I said that Peterson was ritual and Verveke was experiential. But what it seems like is that the ritual is important in both regards: one, to induce anagoge; the other, to embody the narrative. But there's a lot of
Now, anagoge, of course, and I think she lays this out beautifully. You should watch the video. She's only got 85 or 100 views on it, so let's give her a few hundred, folks. Encourage her, because she's been at this a long time, and, you know, she hasn't got anywhere near as much encouragement as I have, and she's basically doing the same thing. She's working stuff out. But, you know, the anagoge is the leaving the cave. Well, that means leaving the cave and I get this new watch, and if I sit too long, it tells me to do stuff, and I started talking with my hands, and now it says, good job, you've done your exercise. I guess I got my heart rate up. But leaving the cave, but you leave the cave out into the real world, and the difficulty that we have currently, partly because of pluralism, is we don't know what the real world is, and so, of course, we've got science, and now we're seeing that science has left out the subject, and you can't leave out the subject without leaving all of us behind. That's more or less the point of everything that I've said about the monarchical vision. Once you imagine you've achieved it, you've already contaminated your clean room, because of course you've brought subjectivity into it, because how couldn't you? And that's the point of the Jordan Peterson, Sam Harris talks. So we want to leave the cave. Well, how do we leave the cave? Well, what is truth?
Crossover in these two, which makes it so interesting. So I think the difference, I think something that comes up for me is that Peterson is a deeply religious person, or so he has said this, but he can't 100% believe in God. He can't connect there, whereas Peugeot does, and Verveke is declares himself as secular. So it's interesting. I've had this dilemma myself. I characterize my own spirituality as complicated, and I suppose by complicated, you could say I am, as Verveke and Peterson indicated.
I love that she's got Sigmund Freud looking over her shoulder. Complicated, you say? Religion?
Experiencing a meaning crisis myself. I want to be deeply connected to that real world. I've always referred to it as the noetic dimension, or the spiritual dimension that Viktor Frankl refers to. But I have a hard time actually having an embodied understanding of God, you know, a belief in God, is, if you will, in any kind of traditional sense. I feel like I'm suffering from that same barrier, because I want to, but I can't get there all the way in a Christian sense. And maybe this is just because I've been raised in the time I have been. I think that has a lot to do with it. Yet when Carl Jung was asked, do you believe in God? He says, no, not believe, I know. And somehow that resonates. I do have this feeling that knowing that is outside the realm of any previous understanding I have of religion. Maybe I believe in God more as Tao, as a force in the universe that is absolutely constant and absolutely dynamic at the same time. Very important, I think. In a way, I feel like this is expressed in the description Peugeot gives of the Trinity. And need I state this, it reflects very much dynamic quality. I would say my belief is that God is something like dynamic quality. Again, both approaches take into account an understanding of the underlying structure of reality and proceeding from there. These are practices that can ground us as we sort out the chaos at the end of the cycle or during the meaning crisis. So I hope that made sense, and I will see you next time for part two.
Okay, so I left a comment, and I'll read the comment. You know, I really appreciated it. I think a lot of what helps, I talk to a lot of people who share the comments that you made at the end of this video. I meet them online and in person meetups here in Sacramento. I think for individuals like Peugeot and myself who have never left the Christian thread, and you might pull up a blog post I did in 2009, which comes from George MacDonald. George MacDonald was a favorite of C.S. Lewis, where when I was homeschooling my kids, I read The Princess and the Goblin, which is a wonderful fairy tale, and it's much worth reading, where the little girl has to follow the thread, and she needs to trust the thread, and she has to stay with the thread. Don't leave the thread. And actually, I found that via a sermon, Praying Our Fears, from Tim Keller. Now I lost the thread. The experiencing belief isn't difficult for, say, someone like Peugeot and I, who've never really left the thread. Decades of practice and community reinforce it, helping it to make it very real indeed. These practices and beliefs were jettisoned by many as counterproductive, offensive, immoral, unnecessary for many, and just simply abandoned. It's sort of the difference between starting to learn the violin when you're seven, and I think of my conversation about the violin, my conversation, learning the violin when you're seven and having to pick it up when you're an adult. As a Christian, I don't see that as an insurmountable obstacle, however. And by virtue of the fact of what God has done, if you permit my language, many times in history through conversion, the thief of the cross gets a promise. So I'm looking forward to part two, but so, you know, I resonate with what she says, and folks are looking for the truth. Last night at the end of the meetup, I had a really good conversation with someone who came in. He both came to the C.S. Lewis Society, and then he came to the meetup, and, you know, he's an atheist, and he sort of identifies that way, except he doesn't like all the ways that atheists are getting identified as now, sort of like Christians. But, you know, so we have this meetup at church, and I know some of the negative comments in the introduction to meetups video that we did. You know, we sit down and we have meaningful conversations. We talk about these things. I think that's what we can do to help each other, is to talk about these things, to share ideas. And one of the things I really like about both Jonathan Peugeot and John Vervaeke is they both have the capacity to talk to people different from themselves. And it doesn't boil down into just some nasty little spat. To be able to both be open to listen to others and yet to have an identity and to explore together. That's really what we need. This foe is beyond us. You know, just this morning, Ed Stetzer posting a thing from Christianity Today, the Southern Baptist Church is having their convention, the Southern Baptist Convention. And, you know, losing half of their kids. This is part of the meaning crisis, and what I tweeted out. I don't think the church recognizes this as a part of a much larger cultural situation. It thinks it can improve performance with pizza, smoke machines, and more empathy. This challenge runs far deeper than cooler, hipper, and woker. And tomorrow I'm going to do a conversation with Bern Power again, and we're going to talk about texture. And one of the things that Bern was talking about texture, and he recorded a thing that he gave at LaBrie about texture, and you're thinking, you know, in this whole meaning crisis thing, we haven't even talked about texture and how deep that goes when feel is the primary substitute for think that we use. Well, feel is about texture, and I forget the word that Vervaeke uses. Can't pull it up to the top of my head, but just like we close our eyes and we use all that machinery to see with our minds, we hold our hands in and we use all the same feeling machinery. We've got all of these nerves all over our body, and we use that to feel our way through the universe. This foe is beyond us. We are not going to think our way out of this. Which leads me to, I've got 2 minutes. How can I be saved? Well, what do you mean by saved? Saved is a fudgy word. I think it has to do with all the layers. I like Jordan Peterson's Piaget eschatology. It has to run all different ways, and C.S. Lewis gets into that. Saved from what? I need to be saved from everything, and I can't do it. It has to be real beyond my understanding of real. I'll never figure it out deeply enough in my little lifetime. I'm 55 years old, and walking home today, I could get hit by a car, and bang! That's it for you, Paul! Unless, of course, as I believe as a Christian, this is just the beginning of a much larger life. It's a tremendous, tremendous, it's a tremendous thing to be able to believe in. And what's interesting is it's just been sort of dismissed out in the world. And I think we threw that away in exchange for what? Pride? It's something I can experience, but it's not merely a personal experience. It can't just be me. Well, I guess that's my altar call. It's time to talk to folks. So enjoy the video. Leave a comment.